Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Monday, the 24th of May, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 37 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to continue our examination of the beliefs and theories espoused by Deepak Chopra. In particular, we'll have a look at the form of alternative medicine for which he is one of the world's strongest advocates, traditional Indian Ayurvedic medicine. Is it really effective at treating what ails you? Well, that's what we'll try to find out. Then in our movie review, we'll have a look at two new documentaries, both made with the specific purpose of changing our eating habits: Food Inc. and The End of the Line. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Now, just before I get into our LGBT news roundup this week, I'd like to thank Sonia and Robert for presenting Reality Check last week, as I wasn't able to be here. They did a fantastic job, as always, so thank you very much, guys. Okay, now on to our LGBT news roundup for the last couple of weeks, and really quite a lot has happened, so I'll try to touch on everything very briefly. Let's start with a piece of very good news, probably the best news of the last couple of weeks, in fact, and that is the news from Portugal, where last Wednesday, the 19th of May, President Aníbal Cavaco Silva signed into law a bill finally introducing same-sex marriage in Portugal. The new law should come into force in the next few days or weeks, so we should be seeing the first same-sex weddings in Portugal taking place very, very soon. The Portuguese president is a conservative and said that although the bill conflicted with his own personal convictions, he'd decided to sign it because the parliament had enough votes to override his veto. So he preferred just to sign it and get it out of the way so that the country could focus on the economic crisis. A very sensible decision on his part, in my opinion. And one that means that Portugal will very shortly become the 8th country in the world to allow same-sex marriage at the national level. The only slightly negative aspect of the new law is that it only covers marriage and unfortunately doesn't give same-sex couples the right to jointly adopt children as well. But overall, you would have to say very, very good news indeed. And another small piece of good news is that on Wednesday, May 12th, the New South Wales Parliament passed a bill to set up a relationships register for same-sex couples in that state. So that means that New South Wales now joins Tasmania, Victoria, and the ACT in providing a formal way for same-sex couples to register their relationships. Although it must be said, the New South Wales Register does not allow ceremonies and only applies to same-sex couples, so it doesn't go as far as the other jurisdictions. Still, it will be useful for some couples because when a couple signs the register, they will instantly gain all the same rights and responsibilities as a married couple in Australia. And speaking of same-sex marriage in Australia, that brings us to our third news item for today, which is the rallies that took place throughout Australia on Saturday, May 15th, calling for marriage equality. Thousands of people rallied across the country, and Melbourne once again had the biggest rally with over 2,000 people attending, and with a rousing speech delivered by British actor Ian McKellen. So let's just hope the politicians were taking notice. Now, on to a news item that's not so good. In fact, it's downright depressing, and that's the news from Malawi, where we've been following the case of Stephen Mongeza and Tiwonge Chimbalanga, the two young men who were arrested back in December for holding a traditional engagement ceremony. Well, finally, their trial is over, and the verdict was handed down last week. Both men were found guilty of gross indecency and unnatural acts, and both were given the maximum sentence possible of 14 years in prison with hard labour. Yes, dear listener, you heard correctly. 14 years with hard labour for the heinous crime of holding an engagement ceremony. So what can you say? This is such an incredibly grim and frustrating case. Fortunately, it's had a lot of coverage in the international media, and the sentence has been condemned by a large number of Western governments and human rights organizations, as well as the UN and the EU. And I understand that Stephen and Tiwonge will try to appeal the verdict, so let's just hope that they're able to do that and their convictions will be overturned by a higher court. I really do hope so. And for our final news items tonight, let's head to Eastern Europe, where we actually have news from four separate countries in the region. Now, why have LGBT rights in Eastern Europe suddenly become a regular feature in the news for these last few weeks? Well, it's because it's springtime over there right now, the weather is getting warmer, and the LGBT activists are trying to hold pride parades, with varying degrees of success, as we've seen. So 2 weeks ago on Reality Check, we reported that the Baltic Pride Parade had gone ahead successfully in Vilnius in Lithuania, despite the presence of thousands of violent homophobic counter-protesters. Well, the following weekend, Saturday, May 15th, it was the turn of Minsk in Belarus to try to hold a Pride Parade that they were calling Slavic Pride, because they invited activists from other Slavic countries to attend, mainly from Russia. The Pride Parade in Minsk had been banned by city authorities in the days leading up to the event, but the organisers decided to try to go ahead with the march anyway. So about 40 people marched, and in the end they managed to last about 10 minutes and got about 200 metres before the police swept in, seemingly from out of nowhere, and just began beating and grabbing people left, right and centre and hauling them off in police vans. The videos on the internet are quite disturbing to watch. One moment people are marching happily on the street with rainbow flags, the next moment, the police have arrived and people are running in all directions and the police are just whisking them away like that. In the end, 12 marchers were detained, but apparently all of them were released 2 days later, fortunately. Now, these scenes of marchers getting dragged away into waiting vans by police are very reminiscent of the scenes we saw at the first attempted Slavic Pride march, which took place, or they attempted to take place, in Moscow last year, which also ended with everyone getting arrested. And I'm afraid to say, dear listener, that there will be another attempt to hold a Pride March in Moscow this coming Saturday, May 29th, and it has already been banned by the authorities. So I suspect that when I report the news this time next week, I'm going to be reporting similar scenes to those we saw last week in Minsk. This will be the fifth consecutive year they've tried to organise a Moscow Pride March, with all of them being banned and ending up in violence and arrests, unfortunately. Now, finally, our last two stories from Eastern Europe. The first one is good news and comes from Bucharest, the capital of Romania, where the 7th annual LGBT Pride March, known as Gay Fest, took place last Saturday, May 22nd, and was reportedly a great success, with about 350 people taking part. It did, however, take place under tight security, as an anti-gay march organised by right-wing homophobes had taken place just hours beforehand. But fortunately, there were no reports of violence. Which is more than can be said for the Pride March that took place in Bratislava in Slovakia on the same day. Because there, about 1,000 people showed up to march, but they were attacked by about 80 skinheads with stones and smoke bombs, wounding a number of people and causing the parade to be cancelled. This was particularly unfortunate because it was the first ever Pride parade organised in Slovakia. So a real shame for it to end up this way. Let's hope that next year the police do their job there and protect the marches properly, as they did admirably in Bucharest and Vilnius this year. And with that, we come finally to the end of our LGBT news roundup. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll continue our skeptical examination of Deepak Chopra and some of the causes he espouses, particularly traditional Indian Ayurvedic medicine. Is it really a safe and effective alternative to science-based medicine, as he claims? Well, to find out, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
All day, all day, all night. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman, and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was My Life Would Suck Without You by Kelly Clarkson. A very modern song there. Okay, now we move into the part of the show now where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And tonight we're going to continue our examination of some of the ideas espoused by a man who is one of the most prominent figures of the New Age movement, a big promoter of alternative medicines, and who made a visit to Melbourne just a few weeks ago, Deepak Chopra. Now, we began our discussion of Deepak Chopra 2 weeks ago here on Reality Check, so if you missed that episode and would like to have a listen, you can find it available as a podcast on the Reality Check website at realitycheckonline.net. So last week we looked briefly at Deepak Chopra's background, and then we analysed one of his most problematic teachings, the concept of quantum healing. And we concluded that quantum healing, the idea that we can cure disease and even grow younger just by willing it to happen, is a load of baloney with no foundation in science whatsoever. And not only is it baloney, but it's immoral baloney, because it misinforms people about real science and real medicine and gives them false hope. Now, tonight, we're going to look at two other problematic aspects of what Deepak Chopra says and promotes, which I believe are also equally immoral. First, we'll examine the main form of alternative medicine that Deepak Chopra champions, traditional Indian Ayurvedic medicine. And then we'll have a look at the way Deepak Chopra, while pretending to be a lover of science, actually denigrates and undermines skepticism and the scientific method. So first, let's talk about Ayurvedic medicine. Now, Deepak Chopra has long been one of the foremost advocates for Ayurvedic medicine in the United States, and it's one of the main treatment methods used at his Chopra Center for Well-Being in San Diego. But before we have a look at the basic principles of Ayurvedic medicine, I just want to briefly suggest a framework in which to look at all forms of medicine. So let's step back for a moment to get a broad perspective on this subject and look at concepts of medicine across the whole world and over the last few thousand years. And by medicine, I'm talking generally about the ways in which people understood disease, what caused it, and how to treat it. So every region of the world had its own forms of traditional medicine. Ayurvedic medicine is one system of beliefs that was common on the Indian subcontinent. And in a nutshell, it's based on balances and imbalances in the five great elements: earth, water, fire, air, and ether or space. Now, in China, they had their own traditional Chinese medicine based on notions such as balancing the yin and yang and improving the flow of qi. Europe, too, had its own traditional European medicine, based on notions such as balancing the four humours and the miasma theory that illness was caused by bad air. And in the Arab world, in Africa, throughout the Americas, in fact, everywhere humans lived, they formed their own theories of what we could loosely call medicine. So, for several thousand years, there were many different systems of traditional medicine all over the world. But all of that changed dramatically in the mid to late 19th century, when science-based medicine came along. Doctors began to apply the principles of the scientific method to medicine by testing various hypotheses under controlled conditions. It was at this time that the germ theory of disease arose, and people discovered that the vast majority of illnesses were caused not by blockages in the qi or imbalances in the humours, but by tiny microbes. The application of science to medicine has led to incredible advances in preventing and treating disease. Just the development of sanitation, vaccination, and antibiotics alone have saved literally billions of lives. So the way to look at medicine is not as traditional Chinese medicine or Indian medicine versus so-called Western medicine. That's just not an accurate way to see it. The way to look at it is like this: hundreds of systems of local, traditional, pre-scientific medicine versus science-based medicine, which is universal and practiced the world over. And the truth is that science-based medicine has been orders of magnitude more successful at preventing and treating disease than any other medical approach in history. Another way to look at it is like this. Imagine this hypothetical situation. You're feeling a bit under the weather, but you're not sure what's wrong. Now, I make a bargain with you. You're not allowed to see a modern doctor. Instead, I give you a time machine, and it will take you back 200 years to the year 1810. Now, you have to travel to that year, but you can choose any location in the world to go to. Now, where would you go to diagnose and treat your illness? China? India? Persia? Europe? Mexico? Somewhere else? Frankly, I don't know where I'd choose to go. All those traditional medical systems were pretty much equally unsuccessful at preventing and treating disease. But now imagine that we're back in 2010 and you can choose any of those traditional systems, which haven't changed over the last 200 years, or science-based medicine, which is always changing and developing in response to new evidence and data. Now, frankly, I fail to see how anyone could be attracted to any of those pre-scientific traditional systems. So having said that, let's now have a look at one of those systems, the one most vigorously promoted by Deepak Chopra, traditional Ayurvedic medicine from India. According to its philosophy, illness is caused by an imbalance in the three doshas. Now, it's a bit like the old theory of the four humors in traditional European medicine. Now, let me read to you the description here directly from Deepak's website, chopra.com. Ayurveda describes three fundamental energies known in Sanskrit as vata, wind, pitta, fire, and kapha, earth. Each of us has a unique proportion of these three forces that shapes our nature. If vata is dominant in our system, we tend to be thin, light, enthusiastic, energetic, and changeable. If pitta predominates in our nature, we tend to be intense, intelligent, and goal-oriented, and we have a strong appetite for life. Etc., etc. I think you get the idea. And then the page goes on to describe the symptoms caused by imbalances in your vata, pitta, and kapha, such as anxiety, insomnia, dry skin, constipation, indigestion, sinus congestion, etc., depending on what's out of balance with what. And so the goal of Ayurveda, it says on the webpage, is to determine what elements are out of balance and offer interventions using diet, herbs, aromatherapy, massage, music, and meditation to re-establish balance. For example, you might be told to eat more spicy foods or less sweet foods, or more sour or less salty foods. You might also be told to take various combinations of herbs. And Ayurvedic remedies often involve the use of amulets, spells, mantras, incantations, and other kinds of incredibly successful medical interventions such as these. Now, I don't want to get too much into the details of Ayurvedic medicine and the various remedies it prescribes, basically because I don't need to. And the reason is this. We now know, thanks to science, that disease is not caused by an imbalance in the three doshas. Most disease is caused by microbes, bacteria, and viruses. Some is caused by genetics, some is caused by autoimmune reactions, and there are, of course, numerous other causes, all discovered and known through science. Now, it may well be that some of the herbs prescribed by Ayurvedic medicine do indeed contain an active ingredient that could help to treat a particular condition. But if that's the case, it doesn't come about because Ayurvedic medicine is based on a correct theory of disease. It would largely be a coincidence. In reality, probably most of the diet changes and herbs prescribed by Ayurvedic medicine have no effect at all. Some are probably even harmful. So to return now to Deepak Chopra, hopefully this rough description of Ayurveda gives you a rough idea of the particular pre-scientific medical system that he's advocating to treat and prevent disease. And of course, dear listener, being Deepak Chopra, he's backed up his claims about the effectiveness of Ayurvedic medicine by using explanations based on, you guessed it, quantum physics. And as we saw in the last episode of Reality Check, those kinds of explanations are dubious in the extreme. Now, I should also mention that Ayurvedic medicine is not the only alternative medicine that Deepak Chopra promotes. He loves also acupuncture, qigong, reiki, and all kinds of herbal remedies. And on his website, he promotes the use of aromatherapy to treat illnesses, and even sells aromatic oils and spices for all your healing needs. How convenient! Actually, you can buy a lot of things on his website. I mean, really, a lot. He's got all the vitamins and herbs and supplements, plus the aromatic creams and oils and candles and shampoos, and then there's the teas and the weight loss products, and even his trademarked chakra-balancing gourmet chocolate called Chocoveda. And I swear I'm not joking, dear listener. Plus, there's all the books and the CDs and DVDs, also lots of sacred Ayurvedic jewelry, plus prayer beads and all kinds of amulets, and what he calls chakra and mantra necklaces. There's even a section in the online shop for Chopra wear, where you can buy all the clothes and accessories you need to live the perfect Chopra lifestyle. Again, I'm not joking. Go to Chopra.com and look for yourself if you don't believe me. Plus, there are lots of videos on how to balance your doshas and all kinds of dosha balancing kits. Actually, the website reminds me a lot of Dr. D'Adamo's blood type diet website. But instead of selling you products based on your blood type, Deepak Chopra sells you products based on your dosha type. Could it be that the charlatans are actually copying techniques from each other? Maybe. But, well, what's really the problem here? Deepak Chopra is promoting a dubious medical therapy and selling overpriced products to go along with it. But there's no big deal, right? Well, I think there are two major problems here. One is specific to Ayurvedic medicine, and the other to all alternative medicines in general. The main problem with Ayurvedic medicine is that, well, apart from the fact that it's never been shown to work, that many Ayurvedic remedies have been found to contain dangerous levels of lead, mercury, and arsenic. And these are most often not accidental contaminants, but are added deliberately to the remedies as specific ingredients. A bit like homeopathy without diluting it, basically. Now, studies of Ayurvedic remedies sold in the United States over the last 10 years have shown that about 20% of them contain significant quantities of toxic heavy metals. And I've read of higher percentages being found in the UK and India. And given that the preparation of these remedies is largely unregulated, it's pretty much impossible to know if the supposed remedy you're taking is contaminated with toxic heavy metals or not. Now, I'm not saying that Deepak Chopra is selling those contaminated products, but by promoting the use of Ayurvedic medicine generally, he's increasing the number of people consuming harmful levels of those toxic heavy metals. Not a very good thing. But the main problem here is the one we've discussed pretty much every time we've talked about alternative medicines here on Reality Check. And that is that by promoting alternative medicines, in this case Ayurvedic medicine, and making them seem valid options to treating disease, Deepak Chopra encourages people to either avoid or delay using science-based medicine with its proven track record in curing and treating many illnesses. Now, that's the basic harm caused by all promoters of alternative medicine. People trust and rely on these unproven techniques or remedies, which can cause their disease to become a lot worse than it would have been if they'd treated it earlier on, or even make a non-fatal disease fatal by delaying medical intervention. So in this way, it can be said that Deepak Chopra is not just a benign charlatan, but is actually causing real harm in the world, including disability and death. Now, finally and briefly, the other of the three main problems with Deepak Chopra is his regular rants against the scientific method and skepticism, while always claiming to be a lover of science and a scientist himself. He just doesn't seem to understand what the scientific method is all about, and yet regularly attacks the arrogance of scientists just for doing their job by questioning and testing theories. Worse still, he doesn't even seem to understand the specific scientific theories that he writes about. I mean, quantum mechanics is one example that we've already seen. Another example is evolution. In an article he wrote in April in the San Francisco Chronicle, he dealt with the theory of evolution, but in a way that showed he really didn't know what he was talking about. For example, he said, and I quote, "At the moment, evolutionary theory refuses to abandon the notion of random selection." Now, random selection? What on earth is that? There is no such concept in evolutionary theory. There's natural selection, and there are random mutations, but there's nothing like random selection. I have no idea what that could even mean. And in that same article, he also mentions red colobus monkeys. And he says, quote, "The red colobus monkeys stand far below Homo sapiens on the evolutionary chain," end quote. Really, Deepak? That's your level of understanding of evolution? There is no evolutionary chain. There is an evolutionary tree, and humans and red colobus monkeys are both alive today and both lie at the ends of separate branches, not somewhere along the same chain. To make a statement like the one Deepak Chopra made just shows an embarrassing lack of understanding of what he's talking about. And these two examples are really just the tip of the iceberg. What's surprising is that someone so unqualified and shameless should continue to be so widely published and read. It just astounds me. His regular anti-science rants sound more like hissy fits caused by the fact that real, practicing scientists still refuse to accept his gobbledygook, rather than careful, reasoned refutations of the evidence relating to the particular theory at hand. In that respect, he's a classic pseudoscientist, an outsider who spends all his time railing at the scientists who won't let him in. And for the very good reason, of course, that his theories are complete woo-woo. He generally comes across as a spoiled kid who can't get his way. Now, there's a classic interview you can watch on YouTube between Deepak Chopra and Richard Dawkins, where, when talking about quantum theory, Chopra says, "The aficionados in the world of quantum physics have somehow hijacked the word for their own use." Yeah, that's right, Deepak. The scientists who came up with the theories of quantum physics in the 1920s hijacked the word from you before you were even born. Damn those pesky scientists. And what's even funnier is that later in the interview, Chopra has the nerve to say that scientists are so arrogant. Yeah, that's right, Deepak. It's the scientists who are the arrogant ones for not listening to you. And yet, strangely enough, you're the one who charges $75,000 to give lectures about your made-up pseudoscientific mumbo-jumbo that you know no one will even understand, but will make you sound very wise and all-knowing. Yeah, that's right, Deepak. It's the scientists who are the arrogant ones. Anyway, I could go on and on with examples of how Deepak Chopra whines and complains about the skeptics and the scientists, but it would get really tiresome really quickly. And okay, I admit, it's so easy to make fun of Deepak Chopra because he's always just so ridiculous. But in all seriousness, it is troubling that someone with such a large readership and thousands of admirers chooses to attack the scientific method and scientists. Because it is science, through critical thinking and a careful evaluation of the evidence, that provides human beings with the only means we have to deal with many of the problems facing the world today. So in my opinion, anyone who undermines the understanding and appreciation of science and skepticism is ultimately only doing a disservice to humanity. Okay, so that concludes our reality check examination of Deepak Chopra. If you have any questions or comments about Deepak or something else we've covered on the show, or maybe a topic you'd like us to cover, please send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, that's T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage, that's realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to our final song for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy 94.9. Joy 94.9, award-winning radio.
Hi, I'm Cyndi Lauper, and if you just want to have fun, do you? Keep listening to Joy 94.9 FM.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9, also streaming live at joy.org.au, and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Sol Nascente by Teresa Salgueiro. And I played that song because Teresa Salgueiro is Portuguese. She's the former lead singer of Madre Deus. And I wanted to honour the LGBT rights activists in Portugal who have now achieved a truly historic victory by making Portugal the 8th country in the world to introduce same-sex marriage. Big congratulations to all our Portuguese listeners. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the movies up for review this evening are two documentaries designed to make you think about and change the way you eat: Food Inc. and The End of the Line. Food Inc. deals with industrial food production in the United States, while The End of the Line focuses on the rapid depletion of fish stocks due to overfishing throughout the world's oceans. Now let's look first at Food Inc. This documentary actually came out in most parts of the world last year and was one of the highest grossing documentaries in the US in 2009. But for some unknown reason, it's taken quite a while to finally get released here in Australia. It was also nominated for Best Documentary at this year's Academy Awards, but unfortunately lost out to The Cove. Now, Food Inc. is basically an exposé of the way that giant corporations have largely taken over food production in the United States, and the harmful effects this has had on the animals, the environment, the consumers, and the farm workers. It covers slightly similar ground to the 2003 Canadian documentary, The Corporation, especially in its focus on the giant diabolical Monsanto Corporation. And if you didn't already hate Monsanto going into this movie, you'll certainly hate it by the time you come out. Now, Food Inc. is largely based on the work of two men who feature heavily in the film and who have written two quite seminal books on the issue of industrial food production: Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, and Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation. And their ideas form the heart of the film. The basic thesis of the movie is that there is a kind of veil that has been deliberately placed between the consumer and the source of our food, a kind of curtain designed to prevent people knowing the truth about where their food comes from and how it's produced. Why? Because if people knew what they were really eating, they probably wouldn't want to eat it. And the purpose of this movie is to lift that veil and show you the truth. And in fact, that's the formula for almost any good, compelling documentary. And it's what makes Food Inc. a really fascinating and disturbing film to watch. Amongst other things, the film deals with the massive power of corporations like Monsanto and Tyson Foods over farmers in the United States. It also deals with the way corn is heavily subsidized in the US and so way overproduced and used in virtually every processed foodstuff in the country, as well as in animal feed. It also depicts the brutal way the food corporations exploit workers, particularly immigrant workers, and also shows the consequences for human health of modern industrial food production, particularly in terms of E. coli and salmonella poisoning. But I think for me, maybe the most important message of Food Inc. is that it serves as a reminder of just how brutal and horrific factory farming is, both for the animals and for the environment. At one point in the movie, they say that livestock production in the US can no longer even be described as farming. It's really factory-based manufacturing. The animals never actually see sunlight and are treated merely as sources of food to be manipulated in any way possible in order to achieve maximum output in minimum time. They're not treated as sentient beings that can feel pain and distress. And as we've seen a number of times here on Reality Check, the people making these decisions in order to increase company profits are executives in boardrooms, often thousands of kilometers away, who never have to confront the real consequences of the decisions they make. Now, this is ground that's been covered in a number of other films and books over the last few years, but it's always useful to be reminded of it, and good to see the word being spread even wider through a movie. And actually, I reckon that Food Inc. could have gone a lot further than it does in terms of exposing the horrors of factory farming. For example, last year I read The Ethics of What We Eat by Peter Singer and Jim Mason, and there were a lot more horrors in that book that were left out of Food Inc. So if you feel disturbed after seeing Food Inc., remember that that's not even the half of it. Anyway, this is a movie I highly, highly recommend. If you're already familiar with the evils of industrial food production, go along and get your knowledge reinforced. If you don't know that much about it, then I would say this is a must-see movie. This is information that every consumer needs to know. Now, the second documentary up for review tonight does for fishing what Food Inc. does for factory farming, and I'm afraid to say is just as disturbing and depressing. Instead of the injustices of corporate factory farming, in this film, The End of the Line, we're faced with the imminent depletion of all the world's fish stocks. Basically, the message of the movie is that industrial-scale fishing activities are going on largely unregulated almost the world over, and this is decimating many species of fish and pushing many to the brink of extinction. Governments pass regulations, but these are rarely enforced in practice. Meanwhile, fishing boats just get bigger and bigger nets to scour the seas for fewer and fewer fish. The result is devastation. Maybe the best known example is the North Atlantic cod, which used to swim in great abundance off the shores of Newfoundland in Canada, but by the early 1990s, had been virtually wiped out, and cod fishing there was banned. Yet even now, almost 20 years later, the numbers of cod have been unable to recover. It appears the ecosystem has been permanently damaged. The scientists that appear in the movie actually make the shocking prediction that by the year 2048, if fishing practices don't change, there will be no more seafood available in the world at all, and the oceans will become the sole domain of worms, mud, and jellyfish. A sobering thought indeed. Now, just like Food, Inc. was largely based on the work of two authors, The End of the Line is largely based on a book of the same name, written in 2004 by the British journalist Charles Clover, and he appears prominently throughout the film. And like Food, Inc., this is not new ground being covered here. We've been hearing about the problems of overfishing for years. But still, it's enlightening to see the whole issue dealt with quite comprehensively and definitively on a global scale, which is what this documentary sets out to do. Perhaps the most disturbing part of The End of the Line for me was the examination into the effects of overfishing on poor people in developing countries. The movie, for example, goes to a fishing village in Senegal in West Africa, where big industrial-scale trawlers from Europe are cleaning all the fish out of the sea and leaving none for the local fishermen. The problem is that hundreds of millions of poor people throughout the world actually rely on fish as their primary source of protein. And unlike consumers in the developed world, who generally can easily find another source of protein if there's no fish available, these people don't have that luxury. If they can't get fish, they won't get protein and will be even more malnourished than they already are. So like Food, Inc., The End of the Line is not a cheerful film, but is revealing, well-made, and definitely worth seeing. And both films end up with a kind of call to action for the viewer. What changes you can make in your life to help alleviate the problems depicted in the film. It seems that ever since An Inconvenient Truth, activist-style documentaries like these always end with a list of actions viewers can take. Not that I'm mocking it, on the contrary, I think it's a great idea. If everyone could see these movies and then take the actions they recommend at the end, the world would undoubtedly be a much, much better place. And that brings us to the end of the 37th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 8 o'clock next Monday for episode 38. Coming up next, David presents An Awkward Pause. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.